Salutations, my succulent scions of spookdom. It is ding dong darkness time, and I am Allison Dixon here holding court with a fan favorite, Josh Bermont. Hello, Josh. Welcome back to the show.
If you're holding court, I am always happy to be your jester anytime.
No, you're a nobleman. You're up here with the big wigs. But you are very entertaining. So you're like an entertaining noble. Was there like a spot in nobility for the jokester, or were they all just snooty assholes?
They were probably snooty assholes. That's where the jester comes in. He's allowed to say whatever offensive bullshit that he wants, and people will laugh at him. You know, the nobles couldn't do that, obviously. The persona non grata.
Okay, you can be the jester. That sounds more appropriate.
Cool.
So, now, as most listeners know, we normally talk movies when we get together. And in fact, if anybody has been listening to this show for a good while, they'll know that you and I have been planning or promising an episode on Bram Stoker's Dracula for a good while now. And we were recently having a fun side discussion about vampires in general, just, you know, on our little sidebar that we have. And I thought it was so much fun. We were kind of coming up with so much lore, just possible, like, interesting plot tropes and concepts for vampires. And I'm like, man, we just need to do a whole episode devoted to vampires.
Because there's so much ground to cover, why limit ourselves, right? I mean, really.
And it's perfect because it is, in fact, ding dong October time. All the episodes this month will be featuring a classic horror or spooky trope of some kind.
Nice.
Yeah, so there'll be episodes on werewolves, zombies, witchcraft, and all with different guests. And I might even cram in a few ding dong ditch episodes for good measure on some spooky, creepy stuff. So buckle up, friends. It is my favorite time of the year, and it's going to be a real treat. So, Josh, vampires, let's do it. Let's talk about it. First, I have a question.
Sure.
Okay. This is very important. Have you ever eaten blood before? And I don't mean just tasted blood. Everybody has tasted their own blood if they've bit their tongue or licked a finger prick or whatever. But have you ever eaten blood?
That's a fascinating question, actually. I have not. I hate the taste of blood. I think most people do. There are exceptions, of course. But the funny thing is that my mother's husband, Norton, is a Filipino man. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, he tends to go to the Asian grocery stores and picks up all kinds of wonderful, fantastically cool shit. But one of the things that he does tend to bring back is frozen blood, because that is something that they do eat in their culture. They don't eat it frozen, obviously. It's not like a popsicle thing. But there are ways to cook it and prepare it that's very much comfort food for them. I'm a huge fan of exotic foods, but I have not taken that step yet, and I'm not sure. That might be a limit for me.
I'm surprised. I will say same. I have not tried culinary level blood, like congealed blood, as it's in a lot of Asian countries will utilize that product. And then also a lot of African countries. There are a lot of countries that will drink it raw, that they'll cut open the animal, they'll drain its blood, and they will mix things with it, and they'll eat it as like a soup, or they will drink it as a beverage. It's very nutrient heavy.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, and I only know this because I've been watching a lot of travel food content, like on like Anthony Bourdain stuff. I've been watching, you know, yeah. So Parts Unknown and things. And other YouTubers as well that go to all these different countries to try all this exotic food. And it's amazing how much blood figures into it.
A lot of these cultures that you're talking about, a long time ago, had to get very good at using every part of the proverbial buffalo, because these were
impossible. Right.
You know, food was so scarce that if there's any part of this animal that you can incorporate into your cuisine somehow, you're just going to do it until there's nothing hopefully left. So it makes perfect sense. And from what I understand, yes, it's very, it's very nutritious. It's not bad for you, but not part of our culture, obviously.
Yeah, there's definitely taboos with it, right? Because you go to somewhere like India, apparently, they wash all their meat. There's a repulsion factor of, you know, involving blood from the animal. And so, And then I think a lot of halal culture as well, in Middle Eastern culture, they try to clear all the blood out of the animal. And I think also with kosher preparations too, right? So so it goes back and forth. And I only bring this up because I think we here in the West have definitely have more of that taboo with the consumption of blood. And it also just happens that, you know, most of the mythology and folklore about vampires as we know them, as these sort of charismatic creatures of the night, you know, when you think of a vampire, the thing that you're thinking of comes very much out of European background, a European origin, specifically the Slavic countries.
Well, in our pop culture, that's where a lot of it does come from. It's mostly what we're familiar with, but it bears mentioning that almost every culture around the globe has some form of the vampire mythos. I mean, if you ever want to fall down a Wikipedia rabbit hole about just looking up the different cultures and their vampires, it's truly fascinating the number of different aspects that you'll see and the different behaviors and patterns, you know, because, I mean, we are kind of inundated with the idea that this, to a certain degree, started with Vlad Tepes, the Impaler, and that's where the legend came from. Or even from a more medical perspective, some people say that it was a combination of porphyria, which is a disorder that will not only recede the gums to make the teeth appear like they're being elongated, but will also make you severely allergic to the sun, and have a few other things as well that people started to incorporate into the vampire myth. There were a lot of
rabies cases as well.
A lot of people who were wrongly buried alive. And so you had people emerging from their own grave, and all of this kind of comes together in our minds. But you know, independently, it popped up in all of these other cultures under very, very different circumstances. So
it is really interesting. And I think it's it, like a lot of myth and folklore. It's amazing how much is shared across borders, across this whole globe, how we all have a story, or we all have a myth tied to sort of a demonic creature, or a ghoulish creature, or a humanoid type creature that comes back from the dead and drinks your blood. That is feels like a universal thing almost.
Well, I think part of what makes it universal as well is the idea that as humans, we observe things in the animal kingdom that provoke a certain reaction of fear in us. And our minds are built in such a way as humans that we, I think, on some level, naturally exacerbate that. We sort of take it to what we feel to be its logical conclusion of, if you have an animal that can do that, you probably have something that looks like a human that can do that. You know, if you've got mosquitoes and vampire bats, then you might very easily have something that's got two arms and two legs doing the exact same thing. I think it's a weird kind of self-obsession that we have as a species to kind of, you know, impose our own form onto natural wonders to a certain degree and then terrify ourselves with it.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. And you'll find that in all of our myths, the sort of a way to sort of understand some element of the human condition. And one thing I found really interesting about this, and I've talked about this on the show and in episodes in the past, about the ever-present challenge for us humans to sort of face our own death and face our own mortality, because I think that that really makes us, it's really the one major thing that separates us from the, you know, the rest of the animal kingdom in a lot of ways, is that we know that we are going to die one day, and that we act accordingly or not, depending on where your spiritual self lies and all that. But what I really found interested in digging into the history and a lot of these vampire myths, especially the ones that did originate in Europe, and I'm focusing in Europe mostly because, you know, when we think of Dracula, or we think of Edward and Bella, or Lestat and Louis, it's all kind of that those types of vampires, the blood sucking, you know, gotta invite me in the house before I can come in vampire. And we're going to talk about all that stuff here in a bit. Seems to have an origin, which I found really interesting. And they talk about during the 1700s, and I found this in an article from Smithsonian Magazine. They talk about around the 1720s. And this is when cities are starting to really grow. And, you know, people used to bury their dead at the church in the churchyard, or, you know, they would have a cemetery in the town, within the town limits. People wanted to be buried or near their loved ones, you know, as much as they could. Well, unfortunately, you know, as the population grows and more people are dying from various disease and famines and all the things of, you know, human history, those graveyards started becoming quite full, and they didn't really know what to do with all these bodies. So they would be burying them in very shallow graves or mass pits. And they weren't really in coffins a lot of the time either. They were just in shrouds. And of course, the poorer you were, the more likely you were going to be buried in a shallow grave without a coffin or in one of these mass graves. And at that time period, as people were dying and being buried in these cemeteries, well, what would happen? It would start to smell really bad. And then you add in, of course, lack of sanitation and all these things. And I think that's one funny thing. I know you're not a Doctor Who guy, but you know what Doctor Who does. He goes through time in his little TARDIS machine.
Wobbly, wobbly, tiny, mini TARDIS. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. One thing they never bring up on that show, and I've watched a lot of Doctor Who in my life, is the smell of anything. I have to think that going, especially going to the past, if you're talking about going back to the 1700s or earlier, and you step out of that TARDIS, you'd probably be punched in the face with the smell of shit and human decay.
That would hit you
first and foremost.
Yeah,
very much horse manure, human waste, human rotting humans, rotting animals. I mean, that smell, and the fact you have no refrigeration, so things are just sitting out.
And with that, and you've hit two points, I think, completely on the head. And the first one is, you mentioned going back, you mentioned that so much of this has to do with fear of mortality. Because you and I were going back and forth, and I'm sure we'll go back and forth later in the episode, about the various rules and how fluid they are and how you can kind of pick and choose. But I think that one of the central truths of vampirism that's inescapable in fiction is immortality. I think that at the center of this is that Faustian bargain of, how scared are you of death, and what are you willing to trade away to prevent that from ever happening? And especially since, you know, as heavy as religion is now, 100 times more so back then. So you have people who live and die in abject terror of whether they're going to heaven or hell for the things that they've done. And you have somebody stepping out of the shadows and saying, what if I took that out of the equation for you? What if, in theory, you never have to stand at those gates above or below, and you could theoretically, as a result, be completely untethered from the morality that keeps you cowering your entire life? Would you do it? And in exchange, you become an addict. Is that really so bad? Is that really not worth immortality? So you've got that. But also, going to what your point was about sanitation or lack thereof, that kind of a thing. And, you know, some of our best vampire concepts and stories are about viral colonization to a certain degree. Dracula is the perfect example of the moat of old world sickness implanting itself in the body of the modern world and taking hold, going through the veins, spreading and turning the blood inside black until suddenly it's such a viral infection that there's no shaking it. That's the goal of not necessarily vampires consciously, but always vampirism. It's a virus, and a virus wants to colonize. Another great example, as you brought up, Interview with the Vampire. Perfect example. Where does it take place? It takes place in New Orleans.
In New Orleans,
which is very much at that time still, you know, a French and Spanish colony.
Yes.
And so, and the thing about New Orleans at that time was there was absolutely talk of vampire scares during that point in history.
And they had to bury their bodies above ground in that city because of where they are in the water table, right?
And there were all kinds of weird legends of the plague being, or yellow fever being spread by, it was mostly being spread by insects. What do insects do? They suck blood and they transmit disease. And so this is perfect proving ground. And one of the best examples also, I thought, in terms of sheer metaphor, was, and we were discussing this with the writer and producer, Rodney Barnes, on our show, Press Play and Scream, last year.
Yes.
And because he has a graphic novel that carries the legend of Blackula forward into the modern world. It's very, very great stuff. But Blackula is a perfect example of that as well, where this black man from Africa, who's a noble, who's a sort of an aristocrat of his tribe, goes to Transylvania to try to get Dracula to help him end the slave trade. Dracula turns out extremely racist. Who could have guessed that? And so what does Dracula do? Dracula bites this black man's neck and injects him and colonizes his very blood and body. And in doing so, renames him, takes his name away of Mama Walde, Prince Mama Walde, and gives him the name Blackula instead. Just like, I mean, that's the thing, by the way, that I love more than anything else about the vampire mythos as a whole, is that it is the most versatile monster ever created in horror.
Yes.
The vampire is anything. The vampire is anything that you need it to be. It can be sexuality in a repressed society, which is what Twilight gives us. Like I said, it can juxtapose the old world with the new world and the clash between that. It can be an allegory for AIDS. It can be an allegory for crack or heroin. Be an allegory for a dispossessed people looking for a place where they can comfortably exist and feed, which was True Blood to a certain degree.
Yeah.
It can be a terrifying apex predator, like a shark on two legs with 30 Days of Night, where one of my favorites uses of it was a movie that no one talks about anymore, or even remembers. Daybreakers used vampirism.
Ooh, I love that movie. Yeah,
used it as a parable for the fossil fuel crisis. Now that and you can have it. It can be an action movie like Blade. It can be a mafia movie like Innocent Blood. It can be a comedy, which God knows we've seen plenty of. And even this past summer, what I found was kind of interesting was we even got to see the vampire as a stand-in for the xenomorph in Ridley Scott's Alien with The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which
I have not seen that yet. I've heard varying accounts. Yeah.
And it's basically a remake of Alien.
Okay.
But Dracula is the alien, which is an interesting spin on it. And I mean, you even got Count Duckula. You can do it as a cartoon. You can do anything with a vampire story. And I love that. And I don't like, you know, the saying goes that like every person has a novel in them. I don't believe that, but I do think every writer has a vampire story in them. I think everyone's got some take.
I won't spoil it too much, but I will just say I did write a vampire book and I will discuss it on this show eventually one day. Nice. In depth, because it wasn't a serious vampire story. It was a satire.
We've even got a movie that's coming out soon that I've heard about. It's a Chilean vampire movie called El Conde. And they're using it as a political allegory for a country that's had its share of gruesome dictators feeding off their people. So in this case, it's a literal dictator who's a bloodsucker. I mean, it's, you know, wonderful. It's just you can go in any direction.
You could. And I feel like when people say that they're tired of vampires or they, you know, don't think vampires are scary, I think that's missing a point, because to me, And I'll get to that in a more in depth in a second. I don't find vampires, as they're often presented anyway, scary. That's not the source of the horror for me. The creature itself, it's more the story around it. But the whole idea of it, you know, that gets down to like, and I don't want to like be too psychoanalytic here about sort of like the things that we're that this appeals to in our subconscious or whatever. But I do think that when you're talking about mythological concepts, you can't help but lean a little bit at least into Carl Jung. I mean, sure. There is some definite shared subconscious element thing, I think, going on with the use of this creature. And you know, in looking back again on the real world thing, you know, when people were smelling dead corpses back in those days and prior to, say, the 19th century, people believed in a misguided way that the things that smelled bad were what were making you sick, like bad smells.
The miasma,
yes. And why, like in a plague doctor's mask, you have that beak is because they would put things like flowers in there that they think would filter out or protect them from disease.
Exactly.
Which is really funny because we still kind of do that in the form of essential oils if you happen to be that kind of person that believes in that kind of stuff. We've just simply updated it and made it more socially acceptable. We've repackaged it. But if you're talking about grabbing your thieves oil when you have a cold, there's a little bit, you're kind of calling back to some of that kind of thinking. It's just been repackaged for your enjoyment. But at some point during the 18th century period, you know, this idea of the smell of rotting corpses spreading disease transferred into walking corpses spreading around the plague, dysentery, smallpox, tuberculosis, and all that. And it's almost like a telephone game, except instead of like a fun game at a kid's birthday party, it's just spreading around entire towns, and it's driving people to start pounding stakes into the chests of the dead, as per the medieval custom of dispatching with demonic creatures, witches, and what have you. And, you know, ironically, around the time of the Enlightenment, that's when they were saying, yeah, maybe we should stop doing this. Let's slow down on some of this. And then it kind of kept popping up, though, here and there, these sort of like these mass hysteria events or psychogenic events, as they call them now, about people that were convinced that their villages were being attacked by vampires, and they would send people out to investigate, and they would find that, oh, this person doesn't look as decomposed as they should, or they're swollen and bloated, because, you know, the stories would talk about this kind of corpulent ghoul that was stalking them. They have a ruddy complexion, and they looked a lot different than, say, like handsome Dracula would look. We haven't gotten to that part of the myth yet. We're in the kind of old world vampire realm here. And so it's really interesting to see, though, that what a lot of this in theory boils down to is a lot of these doctors that were investigating these things, they still didn't know a lot about dead bodies. We're still in the sort of like birthing period of forensic investigation and autopsies and things like that. And so we're only just starting to understand how the dead behave, how they decompose, how they deteriorate, what their bodies do over time, and how environment affects that. And so all of these fears would pop up, and then they would just go away once they staked it. It was almost like, you know, they would put the stake in, or they found other ways to bury bodies that would theoretically keep them from rising up out of the ground. They would put like metal, pieces of metal in them. They would like cut their tendons on their legs. They would put rods and stuff in, or, well, no, they would put like stakes, but they would also use iron rods and all these other things that they would like put through them. And so it's interesting to see, though, like how these sort of events ended up morphing into this tapestry that you described, Josh, about this wonderful world of metaphor and symbology and history and, you know, human behavior and all these things that can be distilled into a vampire story. And so I get annoyed when people are like, they think vampires and then they immediately think of Twilight. And we'll talk a little bit more about Twilight. I'm not here to turn this into a Twilight bashing episode. It's not my kind of vampire, but I respect that there are people that like that kind of vampire. Just, you know, there's a vampire for us all.
Well, yeah, because what you were just saying about people who say, oh, I'm bored with vampires. I mean, to me, that's a little like saying I'm bored with food. Like, mm-hmm. What food? All food. Well, there's got to be something. You might be bored with the Twilight way that that's presented to you, and that, you know, I completely sympathize with that. But that's not to say that you might not be enthralled by the idea of the vampire story as kind of a forbidden childhood friendship, like Let the Right One In, or the vampire story as freewheeling crime road movie, like From Dusk Till Dawn. I mean, there's something out there that's gonna, you know, scare you, or at the very least make you sit up and pay attention a little bit. And there's a lot of crap. I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's not really doing anything very interesting, like John Carpenter's vampires, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to like that movie so bad. And I saw it when it came out in the theater and everything. And that was before James Woods became the James Woods that we now know. So, but he was always a prick on screen. So it's just one of those things that's like, well, okay, he's not acting, but.
P.S. Completely off topic. I spent the whole day with James Woods back in 2004. Believe me, he has always been the James Woods. He just wasn't public about it. That's all.
But Josh, that's another podcast. He's spilling the tea, y'all. We're getting some actual celebrity gossip up in here. I am down. I'm down for that. I love it. You know, I think it's really interesting, though, that, you know, some of these things that sort of culminated into the vampire myth are a lot of it was just born from, again, our ignorance of how the human body works or ignorance of how the world works and how nature, I'll just say how nature works, how nature behaves. And a lot of things can be that, you know, if we were doing an episode right now on demonic possession, we could talk about how, you know, a lot of people just use that to describe things that we now call epilepsy or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia.
Or just propensity for evil acts, because that's the other thing too about where these superstitions come from and sort of germinate is that, oh, and by the way, off topic for our listeners, if you hear random popping noises behind me, it's not fireworks. It is actually gunfire. But that's the way things go out here in the country. You know, but back then, I mean, the serial killers and psychopathology are not things that we invented. They're merely terms that we invented.
Yes.
But, you know, the propensity for some human to go far off the fucking rails and do ghoulish and terrible things has always, there have always been wolves in the fold. And so, you know, imagine that you are in a small Romanian village. And people are disappearing, or perhaps their bodies are showing up mutilated in ways that are a little bit beyond your comprehension and don't right. seem to point to any specific animal attack. You want it to be a vampire. You don't want it to be a member of the village. And even though that seems counterintuitive, because then you've got a vampire to be afraid of, at least you have something that you're up against that you can categorize
right.
as inhuman and pure evil and therefore separate, distant from the person that you are. You, a human being, could certainly never be capable of what this thing is doing.
And that is a nice psychological trick we're always playing. Always. It's sort of like there is this cry that we hear in news when there's been, say, another mass shooting or when there's something else horrible happening that has been happening for years and years and years. And there's always someone who says, this isn't who we are. This isn't us. And it's like, at what point will you just accept that this is who we are? This is part of our nature. And this is, if we keep denying that, then we'll never get past it. We'll just keep repeating it over and over again. Or, you know, at least we know, we can at least say safely, like, yes, this is part of who we are. Our species is very complex. It's kind of, we're equally capable of good and evil. We've discussed that before plenty of times on this show.
Yeah. And then the funny thing to me is that then the lore kind of starts to bend back in the other direction, because
yes,
there are a few monsters in horror that you can also sympathize with. There are mm-hmm. few that can captivate you or maybe even attract you to them to a certain degree, or at the very least make you sympathize with their loneliness or their ugliness or their isolation. And the vampire is absolutely one of those. That's a monster that we can then turn right back around and start to humanize again and say, you know, we can be frightened of Count Dracula, as we should be. Then when we look at him in the certain shaft of moonlight, he tugs at our heartstrings.
When you and I were first talking about this topic, like, what do you think the vampire, I think there was like a question of like, what do you think it stands for, or what does it symbolize to you, or what is this? And, you know, we were throwing out different ideas, and I often come back to the concept of loneliness and isolation, because when you do have a character of any kind, but this creature that's limited in so many ways by what they can do and where they can live and whatnot, you glommed onto this earlier when you were talking about diasporic populations and people that have been cast out and stories for that. But I think that for me, and a lot of the vampire stories that I take in and that resonate with me in some way are ones that do kind of confront that loneliness and isolation aspect, because I'm a very introverted person. It doesn't mean I don't like people or being around people. It just means that I don't need to be around a lot of people a lot of the time. I like my own company, but it's easy for me to, because I'm not alone. And so I can kind of have my alone time while knowing that I have people that I can reach out to anytime I want. So it's easy for me to sit back and say, I like being alone. But what if I were really alone? What if I were completely isolated and cast out and had no one or nothing that understood what I was? And, you know, this life that I am in now, I think watching a story that watches a vampire where by the very nature of what they are, they have been cast out and they're living in the shadows and they're preying on people for survival. I think that's like to see what that character goes through and how they deal with that is it's kind of me going like, okay, you know, I have to confront this idea myself, because how good at it would I really be? Am I being cocky, or am I really just as terrified as anybody else of being alone? And so I love that. And that's one reason I think I've read Interview with a Vampire probably about 15 times when I was a teenager, because the plight of Louis felt very much like one that. And I was also a very moody, ennui laden teenager. I mean, I was very much the kid listening to The Cure and crying in the corner kind of teenager. And so the plight of Louis really resonated with me at that time, at that age, of just like, I didn't ask for this. I've been put into this. Or he was kind of tricked into it by his own grief. You know, and here he is, he was led into this, and he doesn't want to be a predator. He doesn't get a kick out of it. He doesn't enjoy the trappings of being a vampire the way Lestat, his master, does. Lestat fucking loves being a vampire. Uh-huh. And so the way they two play off of each other is a fascinating dynamic between, if you could really boil it down to introvert and extrovert, and then just kind of like take it from there.
Well, that's one really good interpretation. I feel like to a certain degree, what you're talking about, you know, most of us as humans have done things that we're ashamed of. We've hurt people without wanting to, and have had to live with that. And have had to turn our gaze inward and be appalled, if that is our choice, at the fact that we have the capacity for that within us. And that because we've done it before, we might lose control and do it again. And there's two directions that you can go in with that. And the vampire has the same choice fundamentally that the human does, and that's represented by Louis and Lestat. You can try to hang on to your humanity. You can try to say to yourself, I am not that person. Even though I have done those terrible things, that does not make me a terrible person.
Right.
And so I can try to wrestle with that and deal with that and push and push and push that down to be this ideal of myself that I would like to be, and to function within the construct of human society and the social contract. And do that day after day, no matter how exhausting or frustrating it is, no matter how many times that ugly thing inside of us pops up like some kind of a fucking whack-a-mole. We just keep denying it. We keep saying, that's not who I am. That's something I've done, but that's not who I am. Or you can
embrace it.
Peace with it. You can say, I am that person. I have done terrible things because I am a terrible man, and I will continue to do terrible things because I'm a terrible man, and this fight is bullshit, just to struggle with myself day after day is total nonsense when I can just say fuck it to the whole human thing. Leave that behind and not trouble myself with it anymore. But it's also fucking horrible.
Exactly. And who doesn't, honestly, at least once a day? I mean, maybe I'm revealing something about myself here, but I think, you know, you too. I mean, I feel like most of us have that struggle inside us all the time, like with society, with the rules, with the pretense, the artifice of it all, that, you know, we have to put on a brave face and go out into the world and be kind to each other and do the right thing. And there's some fucking days where you're just like, I cannot. I just, and that, those are the days that I stay in, you know, if I can.
Yeah. And the harder Louis, as we see with Louis and with, well, with a lot of vampires in fiction, the harder they cling to their humanity, the more they keep telling themselves, I can have both. I can be a vampire who's still connected to humanity. The more fucking pain and agony and misery until being a vampire is the farthest thing from fun for them. And ultimately, they'd really rather just give the whole thing up as a bad deal. Whereas, again, we look at Lestat, that guy's having a ball. But it was Samuel Johnson who very famously wrote, he who makes a beast of himself banishes the pain of being a man.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's what you come down to with a lot.
Yeah. What a saying. That's so true. That is so true.
Yeah.
I think I often look when I'm encountering a vampire story for the first time or when I'm revisiting one. And I mentioned this earlier to Josh when we were talking off mic, but, last night I rewatched the Fright Night remake, which is from a remade in 2011 based on what the film from, was it 1985, six, something around there?
Around there. So
it was around the 80s, yeah. And it's a teen movie. It's a romp for like, it's a creepy romp, but it's a fun romp. It's overall, it's a fun vampire movie, like a lot of the 80s vampire movies were, like Lost Boys, cheesy 80s good time, you know, whatever. Other than Near Dark, which actually I'd say that's probably one vampire movie that actually scared me when I saw it when I was young. I haven't seen it. I was hoping to rewatch it before this podcast, but I can't find it. It's kind of hard to get hold of.
Isn't that a pain in the ass? I've been wanting to watch it for fucking ever. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing. Probably one of the best vampire movies out there, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. And it's a must watch. And I remember renting that thing a few times when I was younger, or really begging my parents to rent it as things were back then. But I love encountering a vampire story for the first time and seeing, Is this one going to be a creepy vampire? Is this one going to be a nuanced vampire? Is this going to be... I always look forward to the nuance, but I gotta say, when you can scare me with a vampire story, when you can literally get into my head and freak me out, you've really done something. And I would say the one of the stories that's done that for me was Salem's Lot. Stephen King in the movie, but in the book, it's somehow in the book, it's even scarier the way he describes it. But in the movie, you'll see this little boy who's been turned and he's floating outside his brother's window. I just got goosebumps even thinking about that scene. Good job, Stephen King. I guess if anybody's going to do it, who's going to freak me out with a vampire, it'll be him.
And the remake was terrific, too. The remake of the movie was actually way solid for something that was on TNT.
It was great. That was Rutger Hauer was the vampire in that, right? And I think
Rob was Barlow. Yeah. And yeah, Rob Lowe playing basically Stephen King with the hair and kind of the... But
that was a great film. And I'm going to have to go and rewatch that one. I think about that one often when I'm thinking about a good vampire movie that'll creep you out. That one. Yeah. And I think Let the Right One In had some creepy moments too. But I was more invested in just the kids. So it was more like, I'm just like kind of, you know, seeing how that's going. It was suspenseful, but it wasn't a horror to me. It was more of just an interesting movie. Yeah.
Fascinating the way that they did it. And especially with all of that really interesting Cold War era architecture and the bleakness of it.
Yes.
I mean, visually, there's nothing quite like it. So was it scary? Not necessarily, but,
But it's so good. It's engrossing.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing though, I guess I keep kind of boomeranging back to the idea that people are just get burned out on the vampire concept. And I feel like context and also especially historical context, has a tremendous amount to do with that. And for example, you were mentioning Fright Night and The Lost Boys. Both of those were the 80s. And this was entirely by accident. But over the past couple of weeks, I've been going back and revisiting like a lot of comic books from the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And it is astonishing. Because that was the height of the AIDS crisis, arguably, was that specific window of time. And also, again, the crack epidemic was rolling out of control. And so you've got Swamp Thing versus vampires. Batman, Dracula comes to Gotham. Justice League, cosmic space vampires. Vampires, vampires. Because blood, we're frightened to death of it at that moment.
Yes. You know? Oh, my God. That I had not put those two things together, but that is absolutely mind-blowing.
One of the best examples of that, too, was a movie called The Addiction, which I don't know if you've seen it.
I have seen that. It's been a while. Very, very good.
So dark and so gritty. There's nothing funny about that movie, except maybe if you count Christopher Walken's monologue that he comes in to deliver. But I mean, that is just such a dirty black and white inner city film. And you've got Annabella Ciora and you've got Edie Falco back when she was probably just starting off in theater in New York. I mean, Abel Ferrara at the top of his game, I believe it was him writing and directing that. And yeah. I mean, there's no levity in that. It's just sheer ground level terror.
It's so interesting to see the way you can use a vampire, and how are we using vampires right now? If we talk about like during the late 90s with Interview of a Vampire, and I would say that's when vampires started getting romantic again.
And also important to remember that there's two different things. There's a sexual vampire.
Oh, yes.
But then a romantic vampire is an entire... Because vampirism and sex and death, it's kind of built into so much of it.
I mean, Freud had a field day with that.
Right. But I mean, but the romantic element is just, as you say, that was where that started to shine. And again, terrific allegory of homosexuality.
Yes, yes. And the way that Anne Rice played with that, you know, I actually showed Interview with a Vampire to my... oldest son when he was probably about 14, 15, somewhere around there. It was about the time I saw it. I saw it in the theater. I was about 16 at the time, I think. And, you know, he's LGBTQIA, and showing that movie to a young person who is already out or is getting ready to come out or wherever they are in that journey is mind-blowing, I think, for them, because I mean my son completely fell head over heels for that movie because it just felt like it was speaking to something, you know. And that idea of if it's not repressed, but it's like you have to quietly express it, you know, it's just like, you know what's going on. And in the books, she doesn't make as much of a secret of it. The movie was more ambiguous than the books were in terms of the homosexuality. If you really want to see it, I mean, it's in there, especially more between, I would say, Louis and Armand, the character in the movie played by Antonio Banderas.
Yes.
Those two, I think, were definitely more willing lovers as opposed to Lestat and Louis, who were more like a very dysfunctional married couple.
Well, kind of, because I'm going to launch into something that's probably going to make me sound like the whole Quentin Tarantino monologue about Top Gun. But...
Yes. Great monologue, by the way. Yeah, I love that.
I love that. But so you've got Louis, and he's unhappy and he needs something. His life isn't complete. He's not sure what it is exactly. But something has to change within him. And then Lestat, comes along, and then Louis is a vampire. But Louis doesn't want to be a vampire. That's not how he wants to self-identify. And why? So he's whinging about it, and he's, you know, doesn't want to embrace it, and he's kind of doing all these half measures to try to have it both ways. And then you've got Louis, who's just basically screaming in his face, "Come out of the closets!" live the dream.
After Louis gets rid of Lestat and they go meet Armand, you know, and he meets Armand over in France, in Paris, it's almost like he found someone who could really take him by the hand and lead him gently into a place of acceptance.
Instead of rushing it, instead of forcing him before he is ready, kind of a thing.
And yeah.
Of course, there's, you know, the gay couple adopting in the form of Claudia. I mean, it's right. Yeah. It's right there. Like, as a kid, obviously, I didn't see it, but it's all right there, you know.
That was probably, when I think about it now, in terms of just being a teenager reading that, I would say that was probably my first real exposure to anything kind of that was brushing on intentionally, like, queer. Well, there was a lot of queer stuff out there I was into at the time, but I'd say, like, in terms of, like, something that was just felt sexual, but very subtly sexual. And of course, at that age, for, you know, any teenager, doesn't take much to to put a teenager into that frame of mind. But yeah, she nailed it. And I keep coming back to this one because I think that's the one that's kind of like lives in my soul the most. But I know there are so many other great movies out there. But I wanted to ask for you, we were going to do this whole show originally about Bram Stoker's Dracula, and we've barely talked about it. Yeah. Is that your number one, or ride or die, or do you have a personal vampire that you relate to?
Yeah, I was struggling with this question last night. I mean, it's so hard to choose because, again, they're so wildly different from each other. If you absolutely had a stake over my heart and the hammer up and you demanded that I choose one, yes, I would probably have to go with Bram Stoker's Dracula. And the funny thing to me is, when I first watched it, I was a teen. I hadn't gone to film school yet. I didn't really know shit about shit at that point. And I didn't really know anything about horror movies either. I was just starting to get into those at that moment. So I'm thinking, Bram Stoker's Dracula, that's probably going to be pretty scary. And I remember renting it from the video store and bring it home, and I'm watching it like, what the fuck is this?
Oh,
weird pageant. This is not scary at all. Like, the effects are nice,
but yeah,
I mean, first of all, who the fuck hired Keanu Reeves to do this role? No, no one should ever give him a role with any kind of accent ever that doesn't come out of California.
Right.
Everything was so over the top. What's with the puppet show?
What's with all the porn noises from Lucy the vampire?
Exactly, yeah. So I remember at the time being puzzled by it a little bit. But,
yeah,
you know, now I adore it because, first of all, and this has this in common with Blackula, oddly enough, is what I came to realize, was that, because also, you know, Coppola doesn't generally, he's not a horror director. He doesn't make horror films. We could argue that Apocalypse Now was a horror film to a certain degree, but even then it wasn't really, like, that wasn't his intention.
Right.
So
right.
He didn't set out to make a horror movie really with this either, but he made a terrific movie and a very fun and compelling one. But what this has in common with Blackula is that when you've got Gary Oldman playing Dracula at the center of this, at the nucleus of this movie, or if you've got this great Shakespearean actor, William Marshall, portraying Blackula, and these two are able to do this beautiful, nuanced, brooding gravitas that anchors the whole production, you are not laughing at these guys. And
right.
Because of that, they are the straight man for what then becomes like an extended vaudeville routine, just like a three-ring circus all around them of the most colorfully ridiculous crap. And it makes it perfect. It grounds it beautifully. And, you know, we consistently forget that Sir Anthony Hopkins is hilarious.
Oh,
because he never gets to give a comedic performance. Nowadays, he's relegated to like the elder statesman actor who comes in to give legitimacy to Thor movies or the, you know,
right.
Impossible. But, you know, we forget that this is a funny motherfucker. He was hilarious as Van Helsing, and the way that he was just able to ham it up completely.
Right.
And, you know, just like in the movie The Road to Wellville, which is not a vampire movie, but
it's great.
So anyone out there, if you can find it, do it. But even like if you see the behind the scenes footage from Silence of the Lambs of him just clowning the fuck around and doing impressions and shit. So to be able to see him do that, you've got Winona Ryder at the top of her game. You kind of have to love Keanu Reeves the more you watch the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because of just the sort of absurdity of watching him do this. Tom Waits as Renfield.
Yes.
I mean, I could go on and on. Cary Elwes, Richard Grant. I mean, what a cast. And, you know, and so you get to have all kinds of fun, ridiculous stuff, like the part where like Dracula can see inside the body, and it's very clearly just a projection of a circulatory system on the beating heart. It's just, I love it. Or, you know, all this great Victorian arcana, which we know that Coppola is a huge fan of, the zoetrope and the weird porno film that they go into, and all that shit. I mean, I adore it. It's probably the vampire film that I've watched the most, you know. But again, it doesn't work unless you have Gary Oldman, in the same way that Blackula,
so good,
just insanity from wall to wall. But you have William Marshall at the center of it, who, by the way, was haunted by that role for the rest of his career, unfortunately. But
right,
you know, this, he's so soulful, he's so serious, you know, that it works. It just works perfectly. So that's, yeah, a gun to the head, I would say probably that's my favorite. But which one would you say is yours?
Well, we've been talking about it for quite a while. I would say Interview probably is, but I'm going to have to tread a little bit into guilty pleasure territory for the other one that I probably put on as sort of vampire comfort food. And it's Blade. I'm just gonna put it out there, man. I fucking love Blade.
I just rewatched the trilogy 2 nights ago. It's on HBO Max.
Yes, it's, oh, thank God, because that's the one streaming service I've kept so far. Yeah. Like, I've cut a bunch of services lately, but I'm gonna have to do a big revisit on that. I just cannot get enough. Any movie, let's just put it out there. If you have a sword in your movie, I'm kind of gonna love it. Just because there was a sword in it. And I know that's really, really reductive, but no, it's like, yeah. Oh, this movie's dumb, but there's a fucking sword in this movie. And the guy in Wesley Snipes, the way that man just moves, his action is so good. It's just so great to watch.
That movie is such a good time. I mean, from the very first, not the first scene, because you've got the cold open with his mother, but after,
yeah.
From the moment we're in the car with Tracy fucking Lords,
yes,
that's all you gotta say. It's like, vampires are sexy. Well, Tracy Lords,
yes,
you know, yes. Like, you're in. You want to yell at the guy. You want to be like, get the fuck out of the car. Don't let her take you to a second location. What are you, a fucking moron?
Yeah.
But it's like, it's Tracy Lords. You'd get in the fucking car. Let's be honest here. You know, and then the inventiveness once they get to it. And also, and by the way, again, going back to sort of historical context with these movies, and you were talking about otherness, you were talking about isolation and being the outsider. And that was so of the time, because the late 80s and especially early 90s were this very special cultural moment of everything coming together for, you know, to quote the song, for the creep, for the loser. You've got Nine Inch Nails, you've got White Zombie, you've got like all of this Cannibal Corpse, all of this music that's very morbid, very aggressive, very in your face, and very validating if you're somebody who doesn't fit in. And at the end, you've got Spawn in the comic books, you've got The Crow.
You're talking my whole soul right now, because I listen to Nine Inch Nails every fucking day still, like I have since I was 15
and like
years
you
old.
Said and you have
culture
that is Marilyn Manson, although God knows he's gone off the rails, but you have this culture that was basically putting its big black raven wing around these kids like us and saying, it's okay, man. You're not alone. We all love Tim Burton. We all love weird shit. It's cool to love weird shit.
Yes.
Fucking worry about it. And if people make fun of you, that just makes you fucking cooler. Don't, you know, be you. And if that's a person who dresses in black and paints their face and listens to this shit, you know, and gives the finger to society, just do it. You know, you
might
be an outsider, but you are not as alone as you think. And we also saw, speaking of, you know, the darker side of humanity and vampirism, you know, what happens when that's not nurtured, but rather shunned, then you get a bunch of kids coming into high school one day in long coats and, you know, it bubbles up in the wrong way. But so that was a precise moment of time. And Blade was kind of a similar thing. We're walking into this, you know, this meat house, and what do we find ourselves in the middle of? A rave, because That was it at that moment. That was the thing. That was what was cool and edgy and, you know.
Get that then, techno music, like, pumping, man. Music, that house music.
But then what happens? The fucking
blood.
Blood out of the sprinklers. And you're watching this movie and you're thinking, you know, is this the most interesting or intelligent movie I've ever seen? No, but I've never fucking seen that before, have I?
Right. Like,
coming down
right.
out of the sprinklers, the whole room of vampires getting fucked up. I mean, it was crazy. So I love that shit.
It called to the same thing when I was sitting in the theater watching From Dusk Till Dawn when it came out. I and my friend and I, who were watching it together, and he and I are still friends, and so we've talked about this before, about how when we realized what was really happening, because we went in cold to this thing, we just knew Quentin Tarantino was in it. It was my first George Clooney experience. OMG, again, teenage me looking at George Clooney for the first time and just going like, who is this man? And so I was already hooked at that point. I'm just like, Quentin Tarantino's cool, because this is early mid 90s. And so at that point, you know, he'd already been the hottest ticket in town, you know, with Pulp Fiction and all that. So, you know, and so we went and saw this and we're thinking, oh, this is just a crime. Like, they're bank robbers and they're out on the road. And we're going along with it. We had no idea that this was a vampire movie.
Seriously? It was
not, we didn't really. No, I don't think we really, I don't remember knowing going in, because I'm like, oh my God, this, and not just vampires, mind you. They are like monster vampires. These are the ghoulish, like capering, grinning, like cackling monster vampires with all teeth,
kind of reptilian looking, kind of really.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, that's not how they started. They started as like strippers and all of these really gorgeous, you know, alluring people. And that's the
great Selma Hayek and the fucking snake in the dance and that whole thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So this way you get to eat your cake and have it too, in terms of the different mm-hmm. kinds of vampires. You can have the sexy vampire, the alluring, a seducing vampire, and then they turn ugly and become this, you know, gnarly looking fucking apex predator. And I'm glad that you brought this movie up, by the way, because this is absolutely my second favorite vampire movie of all time. What I love,
and I love Harvey Keitel in it, by the way.
Harvey Keitel is the best. He never
so great.
And you know, so everyone in it is fantastic. And one of the things that I love about it, there's so much to love about it, obviously. First of all, like you said, the structure is beautiful. And I don't even know if audiences would have the patience for something like this these days. But
no.
From Dusk Till Dawn and Predator both do this same great thing, where basically it's about a third to halfway through the movie that's just an action movie, in the case of Predator, or a crime hijinks movie in the case of From Dusk Till Dawn. And you get to know the characters and you get to, you know, vibe with them and kind of root for them. Even though in both movies, another thing that I love is the characters are mostly pretty fucking horrible people.
Yes, right? They are.
You know, like you've got Richie Gecko, who's absolutely a sex criminal.
Yes. You've
got Seth Gecko, who's a real fucking hard ass and you know, a hardened killer. And in Predator, you've got this big manly group of dudes who, you know,
so much testosterone in that thing.
Oh man, that helicopter must have smelled fucking horrible. And like, you know, and then just airdropped into places to kill a whole lot of people at once.
Yes.
But just like with movies like Three from Hell or that kind of a thing, it's fascinating to me when you can have the audience root for bad people and not apologize for those people, or try to necessarily like go far out of your way to say, oh, but they're kind of animals or this or that.
Yeah.
There's some redeeming quality. No, these are pieces of shit. But on the other hand, at least they're not vampires. At least they're not like a monster from fucking outer space.
Because, yeah, you have two robbers that have essentially kidnapped a family. Yeah. So they're trying to meet their guy at this bar that's basically this biker bar. Then they'll let him go, allegedly, or whatever. But they're not good guys. But, yeah, when you are facing hordes of unhuman, non-human, demonic vampire creatures, then suddenly we're all on the same team.
Exactly.
And so, you know, and then we'll settle the score at the end and see where we end up.
And also, they're not good people, but they're fun people, which is an important distinction to make. Like, you can hate them, but at the same time, like, you can't hate them that much because they're kind of fucking cool.
Yeah, because you have like you have the two dynamics of bad guy. You have, you know, George Clooney, who is the brains of the operation, and he's a career criminal, but he's not a psychopath. He's more like Robert De Niro from Heat.
Yes.
Or, you know, something like that. And then you have Quentin, who is quite the sadist.
Oh, he's totally fucked up. He's completely disturbed. And one of my favorite exchanges of any movie ever is when Seth comes back with the burgers to the hotel room and he sees what Richie has done to this fucking hostage and loses it. And just the look of not just horror, but heartbreak in his eyes at the fact that his own brother is capable of this. And at the same time, like when he loses his shit on Richie and keeps saying, this is not what I do. You think that this is what I do? This is not what I do. This is not part of the job. This is not
right.
We're robbers. We're not rapists. Get it through your fucking head. And Richie clearly doesn't. He wants to understand, but he doesn't because he doesn't have the capacity to. And then that look on Seth's face when he just puts his arms around Richie and the denial, the sheer denial kicking in of just, once we get to Mexico, none of this is going to matter. Of course it will.
It's sort of like an inverse, twisted version of Mice and Men.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about it that's kind of great, is that kind of that brother dynamic, or whatever it is that these two guys, and you know, or us guys, or guys like us, yeah. I should say.
One who has to be literally his brother's keeper.
There are so many things about vampires that are so ingrained in our culture just as human beings that I could call my 95-year-old grandmother up right now and ask her, hey, grandma, what do you know about vampires? And she'll probably list the same, you know, five things other than drinking blood, which is the obvious one. But we'll have like the fear of crosses or religious iconography or holy water, stakes through the heart, or must be invited in. That's kind of a flexible one. That one's on the top of my head because that was in Fright Night.
Yes.
And we do see that in a few, well, Let the Right One In and sort of all these other stories. And I want to highlight on that one for a minute too. Why do you think that particular trope, a vampire must be invited in, why do you think that's there?
I've always been puzzled by that. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's like he has to have manners.
I mean, I guess, you know, psychologically, from that perspective, you could argue that it represents the fact that we bring evil upon ourselves, that we have.
Yeah, it's victim blaming.
Yeah, that we have to sort of invite darkness into our lives. But that's not the case. And going back just for a split second to From Dusk Till Dawn, I think another reason why that structure works so well, where it's like humans, 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 vampire. You know, that's how horror would work.
Yes.
Where these things don't telegraph themselves like they do in other movies, where you get a little cold open about the vampire. And so psychologically, as an audience member, you're ready for that. No, in real life, if this sort of thing were to happen, it would come at you from fucking nowhere. It would blindside you. It would be the last thing that you would expect. But suddenly it's there and it's a reality that you have to deal with. So
yes,
that's why the whole invite them in thing. I mean, again, has it been used well, like in Let the Right One In? Sure, I think that that's a terrific element as part of that movie. But to me personally, when pondering this mythos, that's never made a whole lot of sense to me.
I think you get the closest to it when you say that's the symbol of us being corrupted, of letting the evil in.
Now, I will say this, though. The two ways in which that was handled that I think were really interesting was Salem's Lot and Dracula.
Yes.
Because in the larger, it's not in a literal sense that they have to be invited in, but culturally, both of them had to do their machinations in such a way that they were invited in. They couldn't just buy up the land directly. They had to use, an intermediary who would then essentially be inviting them in.
There are some of these rules that seem to descend directly from the sort of historical records that we've talked about a little bit. The things that, you know, we're hearing about from like the mass hysteria events that happened in Europe in the 1700s, yes, or one that happened here in the United States in the 1800s during a tuberculosis outbreak in New England. I will actually have to cover that in a Ding Dong Ditch episode because that is a whole ass thing. Fascinating story. But then you have things like the sun, sunlight. That actual trope was in, that came around when it started finding its way into literature,
sure,
around the time of Bram Stoker, and somebody beat him to the punch with the, there was a book called Vampire, and I have it in my notes actually somewhere, but we put that in. The sunlight thing.
Well, it makes a certain sense because, and it's important to remember, by the way, and we saw this in Bram Stoker's Dracula, even in that version, it's not necessarily the kind of a thing that we've become accustomed to, where once, and this is something that I don't really subscribe to myself, the idea that a vampire steps into sunlight and just explodes, because a vampire is at its core a nocturnal creature, and the world is filled with nocturnal creatures who don't, combust when sun shines on them.
Right.
So it seems to me like, and even the one thing that I did think was a cheat, though, in the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula was that, even though Helsing's narration is like, the vampire can move around in daylight, and it will only be diminished in its power. But he wasn't diminished in his power. He was still able to control the wolf and shit like that. I thought that was not really fair. I feel like if you're a nocturnal creature like the vampire and you're out in daylight, you're going to be weakened. You are not going to be able to use what would be considered supernatural powers. But can you walk around? Sure, I would think so. Yeah, definitely.
I like the idea of a vampire that can be in daylight, but be reduced in power. And that makes physiological sense. It's sort of like anybody, any of us who say we've mentioned porphyria, and we've mentioned there are some other health conditions that make people either allergic to or intolerant of sunlight.
Sure.
And so, and it makes sense because a vampire is still, regardless of its spiritual origin, whether it's a demon that has, that lives, or it's a virus, or it's some other thing that is unlocked, it's still an organic meat sack.
Sure.
It is a thing in an organic meat sack of some kind. It is because it's feasting on blood, the life force of organic creatures. A lot of they're vascular. I mean, okay, not everything has blood, but you know what I mean? Like you're not going to be feasting on blood and craving it and needing it for survival if you aren't in a body that requires that for sustenance to sustain itself, because you are a biological organic creature. So right. Things like the exploding in the sunlight or even turning directly to ash, I think there has to be a much more long and drawn out process. If I were writing a serious vampire story, I think it would have to treat sunlight as you did, as something like being exposed to uranium or some other radioactive substance that you can't, the longer you're exposed to it, the more damage you're going to get. So maybe the hair falls out. Maybe the blisters develop on the skin. Maybe there's, right. And so, and that same thing goes with really any of the other ones like garlic. Garlic can also be treated like sunlight in the, now garlic comes from original vampire lore. This was being dreamed up back when people were, they would put garlic in corpses. They would put it in the, they would hang it around their doors, not just to cure it, but to, because it was believed that the diseases that were around would be stopped because garlic is a natural, antimicrobial.
Yes.
Element. So, so you can say a vampire would be sensitive to garlic or any sort of, you could have the same, in a modern story, instead of garlic, you could be shooting like a hand sanitizer at them. I don't know. It's sort of the equivalent though.
Yeah. And it's funny that you bring that up too, that it's a natural microbial agent, because it does go back to something you were talking about earlier about all these superstitions and oils and potions and things like that. And I've done an extensive amount of study on voodoo and hoodoo practices.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that involves concoctions like that sort of thing. And
right.
The more you read into it, the more fascinating it becomes, because you come to understand that all of it comes from a very specific purpose. These things are not just hokum. Like, they seem that way paired with modern medicine, but if you break them down to their essences, all of them actually served specific very real purposes. And sometimes it was, to be used as certain natural disinfectants, which garlic, was. Or in the case of, again, going back to New Orleans during that period of time when you had mosquitoes and you had the, yellow fever outbreak and that sort of thing, one hoodoo remedy was called Essence of Van Van, which I happen to use as aftershave, by the way. But, the concept of Essence of Van Van was you apply it and, use the power of positive spiritual thinking to draw good things to you and to ward off bad things and to protect yourself. But if you, again, break down the essential elements of Essence of Van Van, it's a mosquito repellent. It's right. A mosquito repellent. And really, isn't that what you would need? Because they were fucking everywhere and people were dropping from the sickness that they were doing. But this warded that off. So all of this stuff is of a piece. But I will say this also about the garlic thing, because it's applied to vampires, but really, the further back you look at it, it's meant to ward off evil forces, which again, like you say, goes back to the practical use of it. But evil and demonic forces in general are what that's supposed to keep away. So in terms
of salt, kind of like used in that same
salt. So yeah. In terms of that being a specific vampire weakness, I've personally never bought into it because it's too weak. It's like the final act of M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, where you're sitting there asking yourself, really, water was your weakness and you came to a planet that's like 60% at least water? Are you kidding me? So I feel like if it were, garlic would be too easy. I feel like even repelling them to a certain degree, or holy water. That's
holy water, same thing.
Seems to me like the kind of thing that superstitious people would tell themselves work, because they were already telling themselves it's keeping the demons away, or it's keeping this or that away.
And I love when any vampire movie, that's another litmus test for me, is if they are turned off by the crucifix or not.
Right.
Because to me, if they are frightened of crucifixes in holy water, then that tells me that the story is going to be kind of lighthearted, romp, kind of not serious, not for real, because I can absolutely see a vampire being like, but not. I'm looking like a vampire.
Because then anyone could be a fucking vampire hunter. But then on the other hand, sometimes that's the point of the movie, is to make put it in a position where anyone can be a vampire hunter. And like you say, you're probably going to have fun with that sometimes. Like, again, I don't personally subscribe to the holy water thing, but I always laugh my ass off at the final reel of Bordello of Blood when you've got Dennis Miller with a super soaker of holy water just spraying him down and sizzling and popping. And
My God. I can't believe you brought that one up. That is one I have not seen that one in ages. Love that movie.
Oh, I used to love how HBO would shuffle that in among the late night softcore.
Yeah.
You've got to get a kick out of it. And also, like with some of these talismans, again, it's a question of context. Like, even though it's not my go-to in terms of the mythos, if it's used really well, like one version of that for me was this is not a good movie, but did you see Dracula 2000?
I have not seen that.
Oh God, I'll spare you. It's terrible. But one thing that it did have going for it, I thought, was when it was kind of fun. At the end, they sort of explain the whole vampire origins, and the way it turns out, according to them, is that Judas was the first vampire, which is why from that point forward, you've got fear of not just crosses, but also of silver.
Because of the 30 pieces of silver.
So it's cute. It's cute. I like
that's adorable.
It's a terribly bad film, but
it tries to do something with it, though. It tries to make it make sense.
At least it was something I hadn't heard before, where it's like, that's kind of fun.
Well, and then there's also like crossing running water, which you don't see very often anymore, but it's like, can he just not swim? He can turn into a bat, but he can't cross running water. That's another one that to me just, you don't see that one very much anymore. I think that is super old fashioned, kind of being phased out along with the silver or the needing to be invited in.
Right.
They're
more quaint aspects.
So what's interesting, when I was reading through some of the historical accounts of people who were trying to protect themselves from vampires in their villages and things back in the day, they would eat dirt from the vampire's grave or roll around in it, or they would try to drink the blood of the corpse that they suspected could be a vampire to protect themselves, which I found even more interesting because in a lot of stories that we tell about vampires is you have to drink the vampire's blood to become a vampire.
Exactly, exactly.
And a lot of the people that were doing those superstitious rituals to protect themselves later were suspected of being vampires when they themselves died. And so then the village would be like, we need to dig him back up and, you know, put a stake in him. And so it just continued its own thing. But I found it really interesting. And I have not yet encountered an incidence in a movie or a book yet where this was being used of like eating from the vampire's grave. The only reference I can think of regarding vampire grave dirt is Bram Stoker's Dracula, because when he traveled somewhere on a ship, weren't there like crates of dirt? Wasn't he like in the dirt?
Yeah.
In his crate?
I don't know if this part of the mythos originated with Bram Stoker or not, but it did kind of, it was popularized by him. I do know that much. And you see it here or there, but as with some of the other elements, it's mostly fallen by the wayside. But the idea is that a vampire must sleep in the native earth of his land.
I see.
In order to maintain his power. And so Dracula could not just ship himself first class, but rather also plenty of dirt for himself to sleep in. Again, seems unnecessary to me. I don't know. But then a lot of that whole, like, you know, the idea that a vampire has to sleep in a coffin at all really kind of, you know, again, a lot of these are just so, so interwoven with old world superstition and with what right. It seems like people needed to tell themselves to feel better about the, oh, well, there are ways around it, because that's the, you know, that's again going back to voodoo. Voodoo works primarily through a system of belief,
right? Know?
And so, because of that, you have to not just believe in someone's ability to cross you; you have to believe in someone else's ability to uncross you.
Yeah,
you know, you have to tell yourself that in order to make sense of the entire thing, you know?
It is interesting too, thinking about Bram Stoker and the way he popularized the vampire, honestly, that we know of to culturally in the United States, or I should say in the Western world. Although it's interesting that he's the one that took off, but again, it's sort of like Steve Jobs, like, gets a lot of credit for inventing a lot of things that he packaged it and marketed it brilliantly, and that's why he gets all the credit. But there were so many other works well prior to Bram Stoker's Dracula in 1897. I mean, there were first vampire stories showing up more than 100 years prior. In the mid-1700s, we have poems and all sorts of books. John Stagg's The Vampire, released in 1810. Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We have so many of these. You know, learning about the history of Bram Stoker's Dracula, the book, and how that came on, I wonder what it was about that particular book. Other than, was it just he was in the right place at the right time? He submitted as a writer, you know, I just think like he just got the manuscript in on the right day with the right person that just didn't have a bad morning for whatever reason. And then was just like, this is the greatest thing ever, you know, despite hundreds of years or more of, you know, vampire literature out there and penny dreadfuls and things like that.
Here's
so
my theory about that, because and again, circling back to the idea of, it all depends on context. It all depends on that point of history. Now, as you say, there had been vampire stories before then that didn't really catch the imagination as much. But we were standing on the precipice at that particular moment of a new century, and beyond that, a new millennium. And you had all of these technological revolutions and industrial revolutions all kind of happening at once in a very short span of time. And suddenly everything is about the new invention, the new discovery, the new this or that. And someday we're all going to have our homes wired with this new thing called electricity that's going to make our lives easier and all of that. And again, what is Dracula about? Dracula is about the old world coming to assault the modern world. It's about The fact that we can continue to dream up fantastic new horseless carriages and zoetropes and this and that, and tell ourselves that that distances us, that that separates us from our superstitious past, but it's still fucking there. We're not going to outrun it that easily.
It's a message I think needed to be heard when you really put it in the context of that time, because you were right at the peak or the thick of or the dawning of the Industrial Revolution.
And also the Victorian yes. era. And what were the Victorians hung up on the most? Sex. And that's
sexy what times.
It's about, because again, you've got the very, very literal exchange of fluids, and it scared the dickens out of them. And so all of this coming together, the, you know, kind of uncertainty of the future, the fear of the past, the terror of sex, and the sort of libertine attitude that could come along with it.
Because there was all these diseases going around then too that were terrifying.
And people, disease, you know? Disease was frightening mm-hmm. the shit out of everyone, which is why I love how much of Van Helsing and Seward sort of break it down into a disorder of the blood in Bram Stoker's Dracula. And those shots in the movie were fantastic, you know?
Right.
You know, we were talking about like, earlier, because I wanted to ask, like, you were talking about the nature of vampirism, whether it's, you know, a virus or demonic this or that. What do you think is the actual kernel of it? What do you think it is that's transmitted, that gets inside and that turns you into a vampire?
You know, I find myself continuing to go back to the idea of a pathogen of some kind. But I feel that there is a more of a level to it, similar to when we think of the way things like herpes viruses behave in people. If you've caught chickenpox, how you can get the shingles later on, or
certainly syphilis. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Or any of these other diseases that love to just kind of lay dormant in the system. Or there are also, you know, in all the studies of COVID that have been going on, and all this long COVID and everything that they're trying to find the cause of, or if you get mono and then develop Epstein-Barr, which is a chronic fatigue syndrome yeah. kind of a thing. And so I would say, and I tend to be a very logical kind of linear thinker, much to my chagrin, but I tend to feel more at home with theories like that, just in terms of, if I were, again, coming up with a vampire story, I think that's the one that would probably serve as the stronger foundation. But I mean, I also love a demonic possession story, because I find that demonic possession stories live more in the mind. They talk about, you know, the sort of effects of losing control or losing oneself. I feel like that's the metaphor for me with how possession stories work. And speaking as a non-Christian person, I'm still very affected by stories like The Exorcist. And I'm still very attached to sort of the iconography of certain religion, religious stuff. I love, you know, despite everything we know about the Catholic Church, there's just something about the concept of a battle priest or something. You know, he's in his robes and he's got the power, you know, like he's a cleric, or he's a, you know, one of these sort of like old world, like doing battle with demons guys. He's a Diablo character. I mean, that's kind of like how I tend to think of it. But I think for the kind of things that I get into and the stories that I tell, I love a pathogen tale. I love an idea of something that is born in blood, because it is blood. So maybe that's highly unoriginal of me, but that's kind of where I go.
Same, because, and that's why, again, I don't think that the trappings of, you know, like, for example, let's say that it's the 1700s and mm-hmm. you live in a small village in the Carpathian Mountains with your family, and one of your family members takes ill. In that context, what are you probably going to do to make them better? You sprinkle holy water on them. You're going to hang garlic around them, because that's what you know. That's all you know in terms of warding off bad things. You don't know from medicine. You don't have that knowledge or that skill. Probably no one in the village has that knowledge or that skill. And from there, only one of two things can happen. The person gets better, in which case the stuff that you did clearly worked,
or the person doesn't get better and dies, in which case, you know, God clearly had a plan. But either way, like, it's not really affecting what's going on one way or the other. And so I don't think it would with this either. But I think that when you've got these vampire myths coming up, and again, you can tie it to any number of real world illnesses that would have been running rampant at that time, you can see that disease changes the body. You can see that it can turn a person physically from one thing into a very fucking different thing. And I think that that's where a lot of it comes from is, you know, cancer can grow entire new masses within your body or from it, outside of it, from your skin. I mean, so you've got a superstitious, backward, uneducated people watching these changes, just sort of nightmarish, horrible changes take place and transposing that. And so that's why I think that it is absolutely a pathogen. And as a pathogen, clearly goes above and beyond what we know of most bloodborne illnesses, in the sense that if we're dealing with something that can turn someone immortal, that can make somebody regenerate, that can make someone shrug off an entire clip full of bullets when it's pumped into them, or anything else, then clearly what you've got is something special. It's not just infecting you, it's changing you from the inside out. I would be willing to bet that if you opened up a vampire's body, if you managed to kill it, you'd find any number of strange new organs inside that allow it to process blood in a different manner, that allows it to nourish cells in a different manner, that allows it to be stronger, be faster, see at night. I mean, these are physical changes that this thing has wrought, but also needs to be fed.
It anchors it to reality even more, because if you look at some of the science and some of the research that's been done on creatures that are essentially can regenerate their cells very, very rapidly. The naked mole rat, for instance, and I think that axolotls, and there are some other creatures that are very similar to this, where they don't have cancer. They shed their old cells and produce new ones so quickly that they are essentially always young, as far as biology is concerned. And we are looking actively for ways that we can give this gift to ourselves genetically. And there are genetic therapies already for all sorts of things. So honestly, we're not that far from being able to do this for ourselves on some level, genetic level. You know, that's a whole other can of worms when you talk about, like, are we even prepared to have a world where human beings can live that long? Absolutely not. As far as the world we've built for ourselves, we're already living too fucking long for it.
Exactly.
But there is, you know, on its base level, there is this whole other idea of we can slow down the processes that age us and that kill us.
And blood is a huge part of that. And there's this weird dweeb who's been in the news for the past month or two. I don't remember his name and I don't intend to learn it. But this strange billionaire whose whole like immortality project is actually pumping out old blood and having new blood pumped, young blood pumped into him. This is you know, nothing new as a concept.
Yeah,
but it's freaky to see it in, you know, in real life. And that, by the way, because it, you know, of the vampirism as pathogen thing, in my personal mythology, there's two ways, it seems to me, to really effectively actually kill this thing. One would be a stake through the heart, because the heart is the engine. Whatever else is going on in this thing's body, the heart needs to pump the stolen blood to the other organs and other parts of it. Because in theory, most of the organs are still functioning as they did pre-vampirism, just functioning on a somewhat different level. You know, for example, your lungs, maybe you don't need those anymore because you're dead. You don't need air. In theory, vampirism is an anaerobic virus, doesn't want oxygen. On the other hand, you would still need to have some kind of a gastrointestinal system to process the blood that you're consuming.
Yeah, you have to have a metabolism.
Right.
If you're, ingesting.
Yeah, so certain things, you know, and that's not to say, you know, probably liver or kidneys or that sort of thing. Now, let's say somebody blows a hollow point round through that liver, it'll heal quickly. That's part of the whole thing.
It's like Wolverine.
Exactly like Wolverine, mm-hmm. precisely. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the stake for the heart makes sense in the same way that a, you know, stake for the motor of a car makes sense. The car ain't going anywhere.
And beheading, same thing.
Beheading is the same thing. You'd still need the brain to coordinate the rest of the body. Brain's separated from the body, that's the end of it. I mean, you're not going to grow another little body under there. It's just not going to happen. And you're not going to grow another head, because by that point, your body stopped functioning. So those two things only, I feel, short of, like you said, some interminable length of time in the sun. And even then, like, I think probably it could go a full 12 hours and then limp its way home looking like shit and like shit. But ultimately, I don't think the sun's going to kill it. The sun might weaken it so somebody else can kill it. That would
make sense.
But so that's kind of my my theory on that whole thing. But that's mostly the weaknesses. And I wanted to ask you, like, but what in your opinion would be the powers? Because we hear a lot of different bullshit about vampire actual abilities. So what are your thoughts on that?
I like a vampire who has the ability to leap or climb or do things very, I would say, in a way that's befits a typical predator. If you look at predator-prey type relationships, I think, some of the scariest predators, even big ones like bears, a bear is a big lumbering creature and you can kind of like scare it away, but it can climb trees. It can get into shit. It's smart, you know? So I like a vampire that's hard to escape. I'm not necessarily into a vampire that can fly, because that's just... I'm kind of weird about flying as anything. Maybe because I just don't like flying.
I guess it's kind of gilding a lily to a certain degree, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's just giving them too much. I mean, you can already live forever, and if you're careful. And but I like the idea that, maybe you can just leap right up the stairs real easy. Maybe you're like an Usain Bolt in terms of being able to run well. I mean, you're eating blood or drinking blood. That's pure oxygen, baby, like in those red blood cells. I would imagine that when you drink blood, maybe for that first hour or so, it's like having a Monster energy drink or something like that. That's just like, whoop, I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. And then that power diminishes. So that makes sense. We haven't touched on this yet, but I think the thing that makes a vampire interesting, and I think that is realistically something that has developed when you live for a very long time, especially, is the psychological powers, the ability to influence people and hold them in your thrall, which is a word that is used in conjunction with vampires for a reason, because there is that whole relationship between the master and the fledgling, or the
ghoul,
the sub. Yeah, exactly. So I think that a vampire's truest power, apart from the immortality and apart from possibly like some physical benefit, athletic benefit, is the ability to be charismatic and the ability to con people. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be supernatural in basis. You know, vampires in stories are sometimes telepathic or can pull a Jedi mind trick on you. But I think that we don't have to get fancy with it. I think a good vampire is going to have the ability to influence and control someone, simply for the fact that if they're canny enough and they've lived long enough, they have the ability to do that. And also, when you give someone the gift of immortality, you're going to feel that you are owed something back in return, and you're going to be a giant asshole about it. So that's what I tend to think with a charismatic vampire. I think most of the power would be psychological. You can gaslight, you can convince, you can bribe, you can twist the arms, you can do whatever you need to do to get what you want.
Well, and also because you're an addict. And if you ever, had an addict you up for money, you know exactly how manipulative they can be. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, and they can try every trick in the book. To me, I like that, but in my personal mythology, it goes a little step further, because I've always been kind of fascinated with the notion that in the animal kingdom, as we were saying, there are things that regenerate, and so we have that parallel, but also you have certain species of snake can transfix. It's not telepathy, it's not exactly mind control, but they can have a low-level sort of hypnotism to freeze their prey. And
I like that.
As an apex predator, a vampire would have something like that. I like that idea. I don't think that they actually need to do a whole yes, my master kind of thrall type dealy. But that thing makes, again, certain things in the animal kingdom, when they're transposed to a beast like this, make sense. And like you were saying with predator-prey relationships, the predator must have certain natural advantages over the prey. And since we're a vampire's natural prey, then to my mind, a vampire would need to, by definition, be stronger and faster than the average human. Now, probably not, it's not Superman, it's nothing too ridiculous. Maybe the older they get, the stronger they get, which would make a certain sense. Because the longer you can be around and actually do this, so you, not only are you going to, as you say, pick up any number of psychological and survival tricks, but also, you know, you will, the more you consume, the more strength that you would theoretically, you know, grow, it seems to me. I've always thought it was really cool in movies when they can, like, I think that vampires would have a certain kinship with the animal kingdom that humans don't have.
Yeah.
So you get into the whole, like, them controlling bats and rats and wolves and cats and that kind of a thing. Like, I'm not sure you could control an entire swarm of them or something like that, but you could certainly remain unharmed by them and probably charm them because you have an animalistic nature built in that that human beings simply, for the most part, don't possess. So I do like that. I think it's cool in the movies when they can control them. And very flashy, or when they can turn into mist. But as you said, you've already got an organism, and we are calling it an organism, that's got a very specific set of stuff. So that seems a little, you know, a little too much frosting on top of the cake there. But one thing that I really do enjoy, though, going back to Interview with a Vampire, the scene where Louis transforms and the way that he describes the fact that he has now just a new set of fucking eyes.
Yes.
He can see and hear. Because I think super senses are a part of it. I think vampires would have that. Again, they're hunters. They need to have that. So they would have the night vision. They'd have super vision. They'd have super hearing, super smell, super taste.
Probably. Like any dog or cat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think there's just an awareness. There's an awareness of the world and the threads that connect it, and sort of especially the complexities of the night. And it's the romantic in me, because again, it's not, you know, you can't really point to anything in the animal kingdom and say, oh, that has that. But it's just me personally, I always thought that was a nifty little addition of, like, you know, it can't be all bad being a vampire. I think that there's a lot that you'd be saying yes to
if you made
that decision, as opposed to just living forever and having to drink blood to do it, you know, kind of a thing.
I would think a lot of people, once they are given that particular power, if they were turned, and let's say in the style of Louis, and they awoke as this, you know, creature that could live forever, so long as, I love how you compare it to addiction, by the way, because I think that's really what it boils down to. And you're right, it is all part of that deal with the devil. When you realize that that is what your life is going to be, I think us humans being very adaptable creatures, we just, that is a form of adaptation. If you're spending like 100 years fighting it, being miserable, like Louis was. I love when Lestat just finally, at the end of the movie, where he's like, all of, like, so many years, all this whining, God, you know, is
Lestat,
it's just, yeah, yes, exactly. And it's like, in that moment, I mean, I kind of get it, you know, and when you have to spend half of eternity with another person and all they're doing is just complaining and moping around, and it's like, God, get over it already. I mean, there's definitely like a part of that, like the meaner part of yourself, your persona, where, yeah, you're kind of like going, yeah, buck up, buttercup. It sucks, but here you are. So maybe you don't want to, you know, kill people, but come on.
Yeah, well, again, it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, where, you know, all of this morality and all of this hand-wringing, but deep down, we all really would just love to fucking let go of it to a certain degree and
be
the worst, most unapologetically awful versions of ourselves and not care and not be burdened with the guilt that comes along.
And I think we're self-aware enough to even know that. And I think that's why it continues, I think, to be expressed in a lot of these stories, is that, to put it from a Spider-Man movie, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. That's a thing that we foist on ourselves. That's a thing we tell ourselves.
But again, it doesn't have to.
But it's like,
you can exactly. have power and do whatever the fuck you feel like. And Uncle Ben's dead, so he can't say shit about it.
Yeah. Look what happened to him. Didn't help him out, did it? So it is a beautiful and interesting and fun and exciting and an inventive way. I love the idea of when you sit down to tell a story about, or tell your own vampire story, that you can create your own sort of bespoke character, kind of as we've been doing here, because we've been talking about these rules. Yeah. And it's like, this is the design that I'm going to come up with for this. It's like designing your dream car or designing any other dream thing. It's like, I'm going to design a vampire, and this is, you know, is going to be his strengths. These are going to be his weaknesses. How is he going to look? How is he going to live? How does he get money? How does he survive? What would a vampire do these days? Are they going to be crypto guys? You know, a day traders?
Maybe
as the world evolves and we become, you know, we have these new ways of living and spending money and, you know, accumulating wealth or losing wealth or whatnot. A vampire today in this world where inflation is through the roof and everybody except for, you know, a few billionaires is kind of going through it a little bit right now. It's like, what if you are living forever? You know, you got to get really inventive and you have to constantly be looking for ways to adapt. And I tell you what, we're sitting here 40 years old or older and we're trying to figure that shit out for ourselves now, knowing that we have an end date at some point in the future. So do I want to be a vampire? Would you, if you were offered that gift, Josh? I guess that's a good thing that we can kind of round this up, you know, and kind of start to
close this down. Actually.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you go first, because I really want to know.
So before I answer, just to be really, really clear, this is based on the rules that you and I have just set in terms of vampirism. No more, no less, right? Like that's the decision that I'm making. Okay. So we're talking about a situation where, again, I can go out in the sun if I really, really like to. Which is really seems to be what most vampires whine about the most. You know, so there was a time when I would have said no. There was a time when I would have thought that living that way by drinking the blood of other people and in theory killing them, although I imagine that that's not mutually exclusive. Like you could, in theory, I would think, feed off people and not kill them.
Right.
And maybe if you can mesmerize them, they don't even have to know what the hell happened, or you can drug them. Or something,
right?
Like that, you know. These days, I look around and I think, abso-fucking-lutely, please, by all means, because there are so many people. There are so many people. It's a horrible thing for me to say. I look around and I think you could stand to lose a couple of pints, my friend, or perhaps all of them. We live in a world where I look around and I see evil in every direction. I see people who are taking up space that simply ought not be. And I also see a world with enough isolation at this point, everyone so caught up in their own worlds and their own minds and their own bullshit that they can't even be bothered to look around them. They're just tied to their screens constantly. They'd never see you coming. And it would be unprecedented in terms of ease to be able to, you know, sneak into these people's houses using these abilities, or God knows, go on a spree in Washington, D.C. Start to ask yourself, you know, whether you should make a list of the billionaires around the world at this point, and maybe start paying them each a visit one by one. And in the end, tell yourself, you know, that you may be a monster, but you're just picking people off one at a time. The real monsters are the ones who are sucking the blood out of the fucking planet. And I think I'd be okay with that. I think I could justify my existence very, very perfectly in the same way a mosquito does, by saying I'm part of the fucking ecosystem, baby.
Yeah.
I'm just
your biological role has changed. I mean, that's the thing. When you accept that, when you become that vampire, you are no longer really a human point. So you're not really constrained the same way.
Yeah. And what would I be worried about? Losing my humanity? Look around. I already feel like I've lost most of it. You know, am I worried about being an outsider and being alone?
Not anymore. Look around.
COVID really proved for a lot of us that, yeah, staying isolated inside most hours of the day. All right.
And that's just it, too. What's the boogeyman now? What are we all in thrall of now? We're all living in virus land, baby. So what's the difference if one more virus is walking among you? It's kind of my way of looking at it. I'd have fun doing it. But what about you?
Honestly, I feel like it's performative whenever we say things like, I don't want to live forever. I think that's a curse. Or I honestly have often complained throughout my life that I'm pissed off that this is all the time I get. Because there's too much I want to do. There's too much I want to see. There's too much I want to learn. I could think I could make use of maybe 3 or 4 more lifetimes. So there might be a point that I'm ready to get off the train, but I'm already pretty well convinced that what lifespan I've been given, even if I live to be, you know, as old as my grandmother, is not going to be nearly enough. And because you know what, those last 20 years are going to be hell anyway. You're going to be infirm, you're going to be suffering, you're going to be worried about money. You're going to take everything that we are now and put it into a package that is falling apart even more. And that to me is, in watching my family members age and watching my parents age, watching my parents deal with their parents dying, seeing all that, and my grandparents so far have not had quick and easy deaths. They went slow and painful and really not completely cognizant of anything. And that to me is a fucking curse. So I would take it just on that basis alone. I would say abso-fucking-lutely, because if this is what I have to do, and if I have a moral quandary about having to go out and hunt, then there are ways to get your blood. It doesn't have to be a person, well, living, breathing person. I can get blood. So like, you want a blood? I can get blood anytime. You know, it could be like Big Lebowski talking about a toe. So, you know, I would, without question, I would not feel a moment of sadness or regret about it, I don't think, because I would always find a way to occupy my time. And I just given my own personality and just what I tend to do. And it's not that I'm quote unquote afraid of death. I guess I am. I'm not really so much afraid of death as I am of getting to the threshold and this failing body.
That's just it too, because it's the funny thing to me, not really funny, is that our generation, yours and mine specifically, for our age is sicker and weaker than any previous generation in modern times. You would have to go back to when lifespans were about 40 years to find a point where people were suffering from as many chronic physical maladies, people of your age and my age. And that's unprecedented, and it's fucked up, and it's scary. We're all on some, at least one kind of medication. We're, you know, our bodies are, you know, in the condition that they shouldn't be until they reach the 70s, but we're in our 40s, and here we are. And none of us, I think, are dealing with it very well, nor should we. It's just unnatural. And you could spend 3 more podcasts trying to figure out why this has happened to us specifically. And God knows I have my theories. But in the context of this specific question, you've got, it suddenly becomes a very simple, because again, for, you know, I wouldn't even necessarily be signing on for the immortality. That doesn't really mean a lot to me. Longevity means nothing to me at this point.
And there's an off ramp. There's always an off ramp.
If you want it, you know, enough. But the question I think we would be asking ourselves is, are we willing to trade in all of our shitty, horrible little maladies for one relatively manageable one, which is that you got to feed the beast?
Yes.
I think that's a fair trade. I think that in order to be in astonishingly perfect health and more, you know, and to have power and have a sense of control other than this one addiction, which is kind of a pisser. But again, you can, as you say, there's blood all around you if you know where to look.
I mean, honestly, we're all, every fucking one of us. And that's another thing that I think vampire mythology helps us explore when we think of ourselves in the context of being a predator, being a hunter, is that by and large, we already are.
Yeah.
But we have insulated ourselves from it. We don't go out and slaughter our own cows, or we don't go out and, you know, do all the things that commercial fishermen do. And, you know, all these things that keep our food supply going, or that have exploited this planet, you know, to death. The thing is, we're active participants in it, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. And so we already are vampires. We just don't live as long, and we get sicker. So we're all taking in order to survive.
Yes.
In some way, shape, or form. A vampire only has a singular thing to take. We are literally taking everything. But if you become a vampire, then you can whittle that down to the bare essentials. You only have one food. Okay, that fucking makes things easier. Speaking from just personal experience right now, I'm on diabetes medication that has completely eliminated my appetite. Completely. I have to force myself to eat. You know, and when I do, it's like one little thing. And it's weird. It's very weird because I have a very big appetite usually. So to now look at food and just go, well, that's not something I don't have to worry about anymore. I have time for so much other shit. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit there and have food talking to me in my head. Like, don't you want to eat? Shouldn't you eat something? Aren't you hungry? You want a snack? Hey, what's for dinner tonight? You know, that fucking shit is over. And so my life is like freed up to do writing and all these other things because I don't have to think about food. So that's the thing about a vampire. It's like, all you have to think about is just going out and getting your blood later and you can get back to your life. You don't have to spend all this time thinking about all this other shit regarding feeding yourself. You just go and suck some blood and
also
get back to living.
But also, and I think William Burroughs did a lot of writing about this, that is also the blessing and the curse of being a junkie.
Yeah.
All you have to do is get hooked on heroin and you don't need to care about anything else in your fucking life. That will be everything. Your entire existence is going to be focused around where am I getting it and how much will it cost and when will I need the next dose. So
that's true.
I mean, very true. The good and the bad thing, because you know, we'd like to think that we're going to carry enough of our humanity into this process to be able to say, oh, all I have to do is go out and nip a bit of blood and then I can come back and, you know, really get good at the accordion like I've always wanted to do. You're probably not going to really care about accordions anymore.
There is that. I mean, and that is an interesting story angle. I think hopefully people listening to this right now, and if you're creative minded at all and you're a storyteller, and this is giving you some ideas, I hope you let us know, because I am having ideas, and I'm sure Josh is having ideas. We were, you know, just about the stories that we could tell that we haven't quite seen yet, at least in the mainstream culture. There could very well be some great stuff on Tubi made for $20 by some pretty creative people with an iPhone camera. You know, who fucking knows? That's the kind of the beauty of cinema is that it takes all kinds. But
yeah, I mean, the Addiction was made for $18 and the ham sandwich. I mean, you can really, if you have a great concept, that's what matters. You know,
The Addiction right there, from the Addiction angle, I love the way you talk about that, because when you feed the beast, it becomes something that becomes singular for you. Okay. A singular focus thing is getting from one meal to the next.
But then you're free.
So,
you're free of everything else. You're just the
part of
that one thing, not every fucking thing around you, you know.
Because, you know, an addict, I mean, a lot of times they're engaged in a lot of the consequences of that addiction too, in terms of their health, physical health and mental health and the status of like their family and mm-hmm. marriage or whatnot. Whereas does the addiction, a vampire's addiction, have that same sort of like ripple effect across their entire life of like of destruction?
I would say probably definitely yes, because then suddenly your family doesn't matter to you. Blood matters.
Right. Right.
And these people no longer have any concept of who or what you are. You don't share anything with them. You're not the same species as them anymore.
Right.
You're not the same. You know, you could walk down the street and you may as well be walking down the path in a zoo because these are animals compared to you. You know, right. You're a higher functioning being. And so because of that, it seems to me that it's like a Dr. Manhattan thing. Suddenly it's like, why would I care about it? Why did I care about any of this? Why was any of this important to me?
If you want to dig really deep with this and make it less about like, oh, you know, poor, innocent, sweet human beings that are, you know, good or like teenagers or whatever facing off against these big demonic vampires. You can boil it down to a very simplistic conflict, but the internal conflict is limitless, absolutely limitless.
And I'd be willing to bet, by the way, that after the past 3 years, a lot more of the population would answer yes to this question than no, because once upon a time, I think it would have been a really heavy consideration of, would I want to leave all of that behind? Would I want to change into something else? I think most people now, if you ask them, would say, as long as I don't have to be this anymore, absolutely, please.
Right.
As long as I can be anything but this.
What would warfare look like? Would there be war? I think so. I don't know that we get rid of that, you know? Because that's a whole other aspect of it, too, when you're talking about human society and it becomes a vampire society. And there's some, like you already mentioned, Daybreakers.
Yeah.
There's all, and you mentioned 30 Days of Night very briefly as well. Although, wasn't that, remind me, because I know that's Josh Hartnett and it's in Alaska. Yes. But was that village already vampires or were they made vampires?
That was the beauty of it, because the vampires, and the graphic novel actually handled this even better, because the way the novel opens is kind of like how Dracula is a Victorian mixed media, where it's not a straightforward narrative. It's this letter to this other person and this typed journal and then the law for the Demeter. You know, it's almost like a found footage thing of back then. The beginning of the 30 Days of Night graphic novel was a series of short, pithy, mysterious emails back and forth, basically saying, this year it's Barrow, Alaska. This Barrow, Alaska. I'll see you in Barrow. Wink, kind of a thing. And then you start to realize, oh, these vampires are planning their fucking annual vacation where they all get together in a place that they know that they will for 30 days not have to deal with sunlight, and the pickings are fantastic. So they
converge
on this town, and they knock out all the communications, knock out all the transportation, and then it is feeding time. I mean, as concepts go, Steve Niles coming up with it's so childishly simple. It's one of those things that you think, why did nobody think of this before? That if you're a vampire, where the hell are you going to go that you get the run of the for 30 days straight? You're going to go there, or you're going to go to like Norway for 30 days. But either way, like, you know,
it's sort of like when stoners go to Burning Man.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that, exactly. Man.
Although these days, perhaps not the best example.
Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Too soon.
Before we wrap up, one last thing that I did want to say, which is this. To those of you out there who, like us, are huge, huge fans of From Dusk Till Dawn, if you have not seen the movie Full Tilt Boogie, seek it out and watch it, because it's a feature length documentary on the making of From Dusk Till Dawn. I swear to God, it is as entertaining as the actual movie is.
Oh my God, how do I not know about this?
Oh, beautiful. I saw it when it opened at the film festival, I want to say back in 98, 99. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's available out there anywhere, but if it is, find it. It's amazing.
I think that's what I'm going to do when I get off of here, is I'm going to go to YouTube and desperately hope it's on there. Cause I come back to it over and over again, but it's just such a fun, sexy, gross movie.
Absolutely.
And when you put fun, sexy, and gross together, there's some unctuousness about it. You know, it's just like, it's so indulgent.
You got a Frankenhooker, another great example.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I don't think that we have sucked this topic dry, because there's way more we could talk about. Way, way, way more, I think, on this topic. You could almost just have a whole podcast devoted just to vampire stuff.
Easily.
And then some of the things that we talked about would be their own episodes. It's just wild how much we could talk about. And I know if you're out there listening, you're probably bursting at the seams wondering why we didn't mention so many other things that we could have talked about. But there's only so much you can fit into 2 hours. We did our best, Josh, but I think we did it pretty well. So if you have more to add, please pop over to the Facebook page, Ding Dong Darkness Time Podcast, or you can send me an email at ddarknesstime@gmail.com. I also highly recommend you pop over to listen to Press Play and Scream. They have a ton of episodes over there. Josh and Kelly talking about horror movies, talking to people who make horror movies. There's just so much greatness over there, and I've been thrilled to be over there on a few of their episodes. So
if I can one more thing.
Yes.
I do have a horror compilation coming out in time for Halloween this year. I'm going to be promoting it mostly probably via Twitter, because I'm too stupid to promote it anywhere else. And vampires didn't make it into this one. They almost did. But still, I think it's pretty fantastic. It's going to be called The Breaking Machine and Other Stories. So keep an eye out for Amazon Kindle, because it's definitely going to be released there on a bunch of other platforms. I hope you guys will read it. I'm real proud of it.
Yeah. Oh, Josh's writing is frankly stunning, and I hate him because I'm jealous. So just as a writer, I hate him.
That's the best compliment I've ever gotten.
No, he's just in the way Josh speaks, you know, you hear him talk, and my friend Chris and I, and you know Chris, because he's on the show occasionally as well. We were just talking about you earlier today, and we were just talking about, you know, how Josh just kind of like pops off with these like phrases, and just like that he just pulls these great observations out of his head. And I'm like, yeah. And Chris is like, yeah, he's really good at that, isn't he? I'm like, yeah, he's really good at it. I can't wait to have him on the show again because of that. So if you like Josh on this show, then you're definitely going to like his books. And I will be promoting them on this show, and I will be promoting them on social media as well when they are released. So if you like me, then you will go buy Josh's book. And that is the ultimatum that I am delivering tonight. So
thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you yet again for coming onto this show. We do have another movie episode that I still need to edit and get out, but I like to space those out as like fun little nuggets. And I know you and I have been planning on doing a Cronenberg fest for a bit. We need to get down and dirty with that very soon. And of course, there's just no shortage. Every time I watch some messed up movie or have some weird movie observation, I want to be like, hey Josh, we need to do an episode on this one.
Anytime.
We need to talk about this.
Anytime.
So, oh my God. Awesome. Awesome. Well, that will leave it for now, but I will be back with another spooky spectacular very soon. Keep your steaks or your garlic close, because if there aren't any vampires around, they can be handy in the making of kebabs. And, you know, that just makes everything better. So,
steak and garlic. Right.
I know, steak and garlic. Oh my God. Yeah, I'm hungry. Obviously, speaking of having no appetite, I appear to have one now, so. This episode was produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon, and wouldn't be possible without the amazing contributions of countless friends, family, and supporters. Big shouts also go out to Nathaniel Dixon for all the show art, as well as Spencer Morlock and Ken Dixon for the music. I'll be back with something new next week. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.